Good morning. My name is Dick Hilden. The title of this session is What Will Happen When We Can Synthesize Music Perfectly? What will happen when we can synthesize music perfectly? It's the third in a series of five sessions this week dealing with technology and spirituality. Tomorrow we will have a session on entitled To What End Do We Worship Competency? We'll look at some of the ends or some of the conditions that have occurred as a result of almost a religious worship of competency in our society and technology, worship of technology in our society. Then on Saturday, I'll do a session entitled Living Humanly in a Technological Society. I think these sessions are probably raising more questions than they're answering, so I would forewarn you about that, but I guess that's okay. Hi, Pierre. Just a bit about my background so that you know the context within which I speak. I am an electrical engineer by profession. I have been in the military. I worked for a while in high energy physics. In high energy physics, particularly.
I heard you say that.
Well, high energy physics is the study of matter using particle accelerators. It's the means by which we look at the very fine structure of matter. I can go into that at maybe outside the session if you'd be more interested in that. But suffice it to say, it is primarily basic research. To look at matter in its most elemental components. And then in more recent years I've been involved in engineering as it relates to computer systems design, primarily image processing by computer, visual image processing by computer. So you need to know my biases as I talk about this issue today. I think they certainly have a bearing on some of the things I'll be speaking about. Music synthesis. Not long ago, I was listening to the radio with my son-in-law, and a rock group was singing. And in the background was a fairly substantial supporting what I thought was a studio orchestra. And I mentioned to my son-in-law that I was surprised that there was such significant musical support for that group. I said the violins sound so good in the background. The intonation is very good. The technique, playing technique, was good. The attacks were precise. The releases were good. And I said, I'm surprised at that. And he said, Dick, I'm sorry to inform you of this, but those are violins being simulated. They're synthesized. I need a synthesizer to say that word. Maybe I should raise my hand every time I mean to say it. But he said, those violins are being synthesized. That there is someone sitting at a keyboard playing that. And it may sound like a room full of violins, but in fact it is not. And I felt a little bit set back by that. You know, I'm aware, and you probably are too, that music such as that in the Chariots of Fire movie, that music is, I think, almost totally synthesized. And much of the music that we hear today is, but I think we're more aware of it. You might want to pay some attention to some of the commercials on television these days. A good deal of that music is synthesized. That is, it is created by something, by artificial means, in the sense that it isn't a musician with an instrument. But I felt a little let down when he told me that those violins were, because I wasn't aware of the fact that was happening. And apparently, and I haven't looked into this too deeply, maybe some of you have, apparently now musicians, arrangers, for example, persons who arrange music for instrumental groups to play, sit down at keyboards now and select a violin or they select a French horn and they play that part and they put all these things together in a synthesis and are able to then either reproduce it with the synthesizer or they're able to take that music for the orchestra or whatever musical group it might be to play. So you can see that synthesis of music is taking place these days. From a technological standpoint, it's fairly straightforward how it's done. I'll just give you just a brief notion of that. All music is composed of, can be represented in a what is called a wave form. French horn might look like this. A French horn might have a waveform like that looks like this. That is, if you looked at it, the acoustic pressure waves that come out of a French horn, they would have some characteristic that a French horn has. And technically, mathematically, we can dissect this waveform, and it dissects into a number of discrete frequencies. We can reconstruct it with great precision, and we're doing it closely now today, where we can in fact reproduce a French horn tone such that you can't tell the difference. The technology is quite straightforward. Another area of simulation that is occurring these days is visual synthesization. I was associated with a company that produced the equipment that made the Tron movie. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's a movie in which human figures were constructed out of mathematical models, and they were made to move as if they were human. This is happening, and we're seeing more and more of it. We see it in commercials. If you take a look, you can see also some of the visual simulations or synthesizations taking place. Sorry again for that. Some of the observed responses we're seeing from this are the following. There tends to be somewhat of a rejection on the part of humans to what is taking place. My rejection to the violins doing that, playing that, is fairly common. Some of the rejection of the movie Tron has been that the motion is too mechanical. There aren't human imperfections in the motion, and so we tend to be a little bit, we tend to reject it. We have resistance to it on the basis that it doesn't seem human. It doesn't seem to have a human ingredient in it. This resistance to or the rejection of this, what I guess I would say is excessive technological intrusion into our lives, has been identified in the book Megatrends by a man, John Nesbitt. He calls it the high-tech, high-touch phenomenon. And Nesbitt states the following. He says that what happens is that whenever new technology is introduced into society, there must be a counterbalancing human response. That is, high touch, or the technology is rejected. The more high tech, the more high touch. So he is seeing, and I guess I better explain what his process of analysis is. He is seeing that, in fact, as new high technologies are introduced into our society, we have a response which says we insist that there be an equal, at least a balancing human touch associated with it. Now that's our response to that. Just a word about his process here. He has analyzed the trends that are taking place in our society by looking at a large host of our publications and saying and using an argument that if you look at what our publications are producing, if you do it on a broad enough scale so that you get a good representation of inputs, that in fact you can see trends that develop. And he points out that this trend is taking place. He points out that the heavy mass production of high technology products in the 50s and 60s was accompanied, and we saw it, we talked about that yesterday, that there high technology products are moving into the office, the home, just about everywhere that we reside or find ourselves. He says that this was accompanied during the 50s and 60s by a parallel growth of highly personal value systems to compensate for the impersonal nature of the technologies. The result, according to him, was the new self-help or personal growth movement that took place. Whether we can totally assign that happening or not, I don't know. I think perhaps there are sociologists or psychologists who could maybe speak to that, but it's Nesbitt claims at least that those two things attended each other. That is, as more high technology came in, more human response or human desire to have some human balance came in. And he said, now at the dawn of the 21st century, high tech, high touch has truly come of age. Technology and our human potential are the two great challenges and adventures facing humankind today. That's a statement not unlike a lot of statements we hear that identify the fact that we are at a point in our technological development where we have some real challenges. He makes this statement: we must learn to balance the material wonders of technology with the spiritual demands of our human nature. Now, that's a familiar sounding phenomenon or phrase, I think, from history, primarily Greek concepts of balance of life. But it's interesting, I think, coming from him in what is a fairly, I think, secular book, that we must learn to balance the material wonders of technology with the spiritual demands of our human nature. Just a couple of examples, one or two. He points out that high technology life-sustaining systems are being moved into our hospitals, and we know that. I think Jo yesterday, I don't know if she's here, but she said that she's a nurse, works in intensive care, said that she is now having to go to computer programming school of some sort so that she will be able to better understand some of the instruments in the hospital that she works with. As this happened, as a lot of the high technology devices moved into the hospital, we became more interested in the quality of the death process. What happened as we died? Nesbitt claims this is the high tech, high touch, or that is the high touch response to that. And as more and more high tech moved into the hospital, we became more and more involved in what was involved in dying, and the hospice movement as a result, at least he claims, started to grow, and that is very widespread now in our society. And we can see this effect elsewhere in medical care. Home care and home births are becoming more popular now. He says the more high technology we put into our hospitals, the less we are born there, and the less we are dying there, and the more we are avoiding them in between. And it sort of makes sense. We can sort of see that happening. That is this high touch response. A few more. He states that the more technology we introduce into the society, the more people will get together. There have been predictions that we would have what is called cottage industries. If you read The Third Wave by Alvin Toffler, he states that we're probably moving in the direction where the personal computer and the technology that surrounds that will permit us to work in our homes and communicate by phone lines somewhere else. And carried to the absurd extreme, we'll all stay at home continuously talking to each other over the telephone. And Nesbitt claims that won't take place, that the high-touch response to high technology simply will insist that we get together as we work, and we'll want to get together more often than that would permit. Teleconferencing is a big word. Yes, Pierre.
Get together.
Good point. If we were to restructure so that we were able to have enough leisure, one could conceive of the cottage industry working wherein we also in our leisure time then had our social interactions. But he doesn't go quite that far, and whether our society is at the point yet where we can think in terms of get out of the working mode enough to have enough leisure or not, I don't know. But that's a good point. But that takes some new kind of thinking that hasn't been quite strong enough yet. Teleconferencing is another thing that has been a very popular buzzword in business in these recent years. That's the process whereby we would get on the phone and maybe have a visual terminal and be able to communicate with someone in San Francisco and New Orleans all at the same time in a teleconferencing mode. We predicted probably 10 years ago that that would be very popular by this time as we attempted to do some technological assessments. We thought that would take place by now, but it hasn't. In fact, it's very skimpy use now today, I think. Perhaps reflects a little bit of what Naisbitt is claiming that takes place, and that is that there isn't enough personal touch associated with teleconferencing. I have a telephone answering tape machine at home, in my office, I should say. I need it, don't I? I need it to be more precise, prompt, all those sorts of things, but it is amazing to hear some of the messages I get on it. What is your feeling toward a home or a tape machine at the other end of the telephone? Terrible. Do you think that the metric system will make it successfully in this country? That is going slowly, isn't it? And it appears that some of, at least the phenomena that John Naisbitt identifies, the high-touch, high-tech thing, might be coming into play there. We probably like to think in terms that an inch is about as long from my first to second knuckle on that finger, or a yard is about as long as this. It's probably likely that the effect he describes is coming into play. Have you listened to canned laughter on a TV program? Isn't it? It is. You've probably had the same experience I have had. Okay, so now let's go back to the main question. What will happen when we can synthesize music perfectly? Well, it's obvious, isn't it? We're going to reject it on the basis that it's too precise and too inhuman, right? Maybe not. I'm going to raise a flag here. In the last session, we talked about how pervasive technology is and technique is. We can add through techniques to the human moving so slowly, imperfections, so that in fact the synthesized image of the human being will be much more real. We can synthesize music that has much more of an element of the ambiguities introduced by the human as they're creating it. My point being is that technology is able to in fact do that. And so when I say synthesize music perfectly, I might mean something more than perfect technically, but also such that it does have an ingredient that makes it appear to be human. I don't like to be too pessimistic on this point, but I do mean to raise a flag. Yes?
I think the listening to music that is perfect is only a small aspect of how that affects people, because I already have seen that television in which people are doing things perfectly, essentially, where you have someone who has practiced a long time in order to do something like a somersault set. Mm-hmm. It's so discouraging to young people who cannot suddenly do things instantly. They do not see that they have to work at something in order to eventually come up to such high standards. They see people do it again so effortlessly, they give up. And I wonder how much this type of high technology will discourage people to be participants and to be only spectators.
An interesting question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Right here, Blake, right here, quickly. Mm-hmm. I love symphony. Classical music. I support the symphony. Seattle Symphony comes to Tacoma. Marvelous music. I think it's a first-class organization. I have found myself, though, enjoying getting more, minute by minute, many times, from an amateur organization in town. The Seattle Symphony is in the balcony, where I can see everything happen. For the local people, I sit close where I can see each instrument and try to as I can hear them individually, because they don't play all together. Mm-hmm. And I get a distinctly different and yet very satisfying feeling from hearing these people who are relatively good players and not perfect players, with whom I can relate a little bit. So there's a second set of rewards from this less good outfit, even though they're still human beings blowing their own lungs into the machines.
Interesting. Any other experiences like that?
I'm wondering how you make the distinction between synthetic music and natural things. Is there some way of defining that?
Yeah, that's a good point. The point is, at what point is the music really synthesized? A person with a guitarist is, to a certain extent, using a technical device to create the music. Interesting observations.
I wanted to go back a little bit to the canned answering service.
Mm-hmm.
Which I can, for years, I just turn off when I know it's an answering service and hang it up. But because my husband is a piano technician here, and all over the country, so many piano technicians are not in the house to answer the service, but answer the phone, and so we hear this automatic voice. Well, and I suppose because of his experience, I have just turned off the answering service. But the other day, I called an office, and I got the answering service, but it was only because the voice told me in the first two or three words that it was an answering service. It was so well done that I was sorry to hear it end. I knew that it was an answering service because she said, I'm sorry, no one's in the office right now, but so-and-so is open.
Mm-hmm.
But it was... well, almost perfection. I was delighted. And I told the person that, she said, well, I don't know how much time I spent erasing and redoing to make it be that personal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot to that. I mean, I think people would get more response and more feedback if they would spend a little more time being rude.
I'd like to speak up for answering services, too. If you, like you say, you do it right, and in my business, for example, I often call, let me give you one example, Alan Bathy or Pennsylvania. Well, he's often not in his office, and I'm always grateful when he answers. He says, I'm sorry, I'm not in my office now. This is Alan Beck. I'll be back at such and such a time, and you can, and then I will answer your call. And you see, that saves me a phone call from my university. I can set the time for him to call me. And so that's a very convenient thing, rather than somebody else answer it. And then I've lost it. And then his secretary would say, call at such and such a time. So that's a gain. The other thing is teleconferencing or conference call. It depends on who the people are. There are some people who are miserable to be around, and I'm grateful that we have to meet them. And we end up a lot of business. Some of my selective, and so we have a conference call, and I don't have to be around. And I can limit the length of the meeting. So there's two sides to it.
Sure, there.
Teleconference. One of the reasons I think that it hasn't caught on too, I think it's getting together is certainly attractive and necessary. But I think we can save a lot of money and also accomplish a good deal by teleconferencing properly done. But it's so very expensive yet. You see, we predicted by 1983 that by satellite would be very reasonable. I just been to an international congress in Australia, and they were going to have the Queen open it by teleconference. And the price was on a site, and you could almost buy out the Queen. So, yeah, that's one of the things.
Sure, it is.
Realistically, holding it out.
Of course, it is. I appreciate these comments. And what they would seem to say is that maybe we shouldn't throw the technology out. And maybe that makes sense. I think that when we ask the question, what will happen when we synthesize music perfectly, maybe can be used more as a question that would direct us toward something like this. Another question, what does it mean to make music? And I think your suggestion that there is a great deal of enjoyment out of listening to a group that is making music, maybe not with such high perfection, but that maybe there's something deeper there. Maybe there's an experience there that is deeper than we perceive at the outset in our struggle sometimes to seek perfection. And I'd like to get at that a little bit. I'd like to share a personal situation that I have with you that relates to that. The reason I went through that history of my background, as you can see, as an Air Force officer, and my training was very, very regimented. As an engineer, I have been educated to be very precise, to be very analytic in what I do, to be very productive, to be very objective. And that has put me in a position of, I think, seeking this perfection in music making, perfection in synthesizing music and the whole thing. So I'd like to share with you a personal experience that I have had. I play a trumpet in the Minnesota Symphonic Winds, which is an adult orchestra, very much of the sort that I would guess you're describing in Tacoma, where we don't play perfectly, but we try at it. It's directed by Miles Johnson, who is the director of the St. Olaf concert bands. And he has said from time to time, and it has caught me, and I'm sure many of us, particularly those of us that are artists and poets, know this, but to me, the technician primarily, he has said from time to time, you must create the music over again every time you play it. You must create the music over again every time you play it. And my orientation has been more of the following. Incidentally, I had a 20-year layoff on the trumpet, and it was only after I realized that maybe there is a little bit more in life than just designing computers and that. My orientation had been, I will master that trumpet, I will develop techniques as best I can to play it. I may along the way want to record what we play, that is our band, and then play it back in super quadraphonic, high fidelity, whatever, and just listen and enjoy it. But always his statement came back to me, you must create the music all over again every time you play it. And I thought, he must have something in mind there more than I'm thinking about. And I thought about that a lot. And I thought about the physics of how I physiologically, my lungs, my diaphragm, my mouth, my teeth, my tongue, my lips were involved technically in making the music. And I thought about the technique or the technical aspects of the trumpet, which has been quite refined, and all that has gone into refining that instrument. So in fact, that from a technical standpoint, it was quite clear to me what was involved, because that's my orientation. And then I thought, I tried to try to understand the relationship that I had with the instrument itself, and I didn't have quite as good a glasses for that. But it occurred to me, I went back to this image of the Native American. I mentioned this yesterday, the Native American making the clay pot. And the image I got was that, in fact, that Native American perhaps did not think in terms of mastering that clay in the terms that I normally thought of it, but more in being one with that clay. And that, although I was looking through very fuzzy glasses, helped. And I thought of things such as Larry Rasmussen's grid the other day that shows our hierarchical thinking, with God at the top and man, the angels, the animals, the plants, then the rocks, etc. A hierarchical thing where we think that the clay is three ranks below us. But then I thought in terms of that Native American working with the clay, probably not thinking in terms of the clay three ranks below him or her, but more equal. And that kind of thing, I kind of brought back to this thinking about what it meant to make music with my trumpet, and it helped me to think in terms of the metal, the brass, and the silver in that instrument. that were perhaps more one with me than I had ever thought of before. And I thought back to Isaac Stern in the documentary that I described for you yesterday, if you were here, and if you weren't, it's a movie showing him being in China after the suppression of the music culture there, where he would listen to the violin players, mostly young people, who had developed technique for playing the instruments, and they played them precisely. Again, intonation was excellent as they played the violin. The attacks were perfect, the releases were good, but there was something missing. And Isaac Stern said to them, "You must be one with your instrument." And that said something more to me than it had before. You must be one with your instrument. It reflected back for me to the oneness of the Native American with the clay that he was molding. And so I came to think no longer in terms of mastering, but perhaps being in a co-creation process with that instrument as I was making the music. For me, that's a long journey, and I'm still in that process, and I wanted to share that with you. I have a master's degree. Maybe some of you have a master's degree. I'd like to turn it in and have them reissue me a co-creator's degree. It might do better for me in the creation. You must create the music all over again. And this had additional meaning for me after going through a process like this over some period of time. I was in Rudy's class yesterday, a painting class, and that had to be good for Rudy to try to teach me how to paint. That might have, maybe should have been called Rudy's Hour of Comic Relief. The same thing applies there. Rudy was telling me, along with the others, don't paint this as if you're trying to recreate a picture, recreate a photograph, you know. And that all ties in together. And Rudy and I were talking this morning how I suggested or asked him if maybe he felt at one with his brush, very similar to the way a musician feels at one with the instrument. And he said, sometimes I think of the brush in the same terms that I think of a keyboard as a musician is playing. And I have a feeling that for Rudy, this whole concept of creation in the process of painting is a very real thing. And it applies not just to making music. I'm thinking, wouldn't it be marvelous if we thought in terms of ourselves as co-creators? Maybe we would think differently about building an MX missile if we thought in those terms. Maybe if we thought in terms of equality with the clay, we might think in terms different terms of our mastery of the creation itself. Maybe our views of resources and ecology would be different if we thought of ourselves as co-creators with those things of the universe, but also co-creators with God. So what will happen when we can synthesize music perfectly? I guess each one of us needs to speak to that issue themselves. I guess my position would be maybe it's fine to synthesize music perfectly. But I claim my right as a co-creator in this creation, in this universe. And that, I think, doesn't preclude technology. I think it looks at it as it as a tool, perhaps as a gift even of God that we can use in this co-creation process. I'm going to stop there. Maybe you'd like to share some thoughts you have or questions. Yes?
That brings up the question of what is perfection?
Mm-hmm. Sure it does.
Well, basically, as humans are striving for progress, maybe not perfection.
Could be.
There's an old concept of perfection as, which I think you'll find in possibly in some passages in the Bible, as a matter of fact, that perfection is not the peak of something, it is completeness.
But do you know that perception is, there is a perception of perfection for a person that is very technologically oriented. And you are speaking within a context that is somewhat strange to the person that is highly technological in nature. And it is somewhat easy for an engineer or a physicist or to think in terms of optimization. Mathematically, and we sometimes relate optimization the most optimum condition to perfection. We sometimes use those synonymously in technology. And mathematically, optimization is a very relatively precise type of concept. So I look for your type of perception on that kind of issue, and wish to step out of the technological.
I do think there's a humanity backlash to all of this great burgeoning technology. There, to me, I think there's a terrific impetus in all of the arts which use the senses. In our time, many more people are doing all sorts of things like weaving, spinning, painting, pottery, and all sorts of things that use our senses.
Yes, I think that's true, and maybe Naisbitt is accurate in identifying that.
In other words, that's one of the good results.
Oh, yeah.
Of technology.
So I wonder if that's true, and this is only something I think you would have to answer me to. I think before this present time, those things had to be done. We sewed because we had to.
But now we're doing them for a different reason.
We chopped wood, we built the houses. And I'm saying we, not because I did it, but because as humanity. Now I'm thinking we can no longer do those things. Those things, those privileges even, have been taken away, or we see an easier way of doing it. So now we play. Doing the weaving and the potting.
Right.
And so
on. That's an advantage.
Yeah, but I don't think that it's changed. I don't think we're doing it more. I don't think we're creating more.
I think there are more people. I really do.
They may say that they're creating, not having identified it, not having identifying the letting, the turning the hems on the trousers and the turning the collars as being creative.
I think there are many more students in art schools than there ever have been in the past.
I won't argue that. I think you're right.
And in music, many more.
You're talking about two different issues.
Perhaps so. Are you saying that now the person that makes the quilt is not involved in a creative process?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that when people had to make their quilts in the past, when they had to do the shelf building, the shack building, the outhouse building, and the latrine digging, that was also creative.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. I don't doubt that at all.
Yeah, I think we're really talking about the same thing, but I don't think we have more people involved in creativity. I think we see the people who are involved in creativity more. We actually may have fewer people.
We do because we're more people.
Rudy?
Well, it's, you know, the whole history of man itself is to create tools to do work. And they were from Stone Age on, there were tools. And today, even this caterpillar and all this machinery is just an extension of our hands, trying to get a job done easier or more efficient, or something like that. But I wanted to say, too, that it seems to me like creativity, it still has to be back for some of this designing, doesn't it? This is just a new instrument or tool which the creative artist has an opportunity to go into another direction. It may be amplified, maybe a different sound is created, or a different sort of lights and so on. But it's still, somebody back there has to do the original designing, doesn't it?
Well, that's true. But yesterday I mentioned a point, and it gets over to this plain perfection. There is, technology itself tends to work toward the most optimum means of doing something. And so technology tends to move the human being out. We talked about that rather extensively yesterday. And so the creation process is there. But creativity is there, but there's still a movement toward precision, toward precision, toward precision. And that tends to crowd the human being out in what I think we normally identify as human creativity.
Is that a kind of a human motive, work toward perfection?
Well, when we pursue the values that of technology that are identified as precision, profit, productivity, that sort of thing, then that process, I believe, just naturally moves toward the most optimum and that it can. Simply the values there and the pressures are there such that that happens. And part of that process is that the machine tends to move the human being out simply because it is more productive. And so that's why I think this question of creativity, as our creativity is so important, is that technology does tend to do that.
But somebody has to create the machine. That's creativity.
Yes, it is. But I also pointed out yesterday that on an increasing basis, the machines are starting to create themselves. And so technology is, in fact, even in the engineering business, it is clearly moving the human being out. And you can even see in that engineers now have become more almost automatic in very specialized areas. And I think that the creativity to a certain extent is being moved out. Not to say that it can't be there, Rudy, but we have to look at it through different glasses in order to retain the creative processes.
Was it the Luddites at one time that resisted technological change? We have to go arise, workers, against the machines.
Well, again, I would hope that this whole process leads us to be in some harmony with the technology. There's a question over here.
Well, I was going to say about, you're talking about tools and creating machines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the tool, you know, there are many, many uses. I mean, the tool was created, per se, to take out somebody's appendix. The reason I say this is because my husband bought a bunch of tools that were surplus from a hospital demise a few weeks ago. He saw all these tools and he just went crazy. Oh, I can see all kinds of use. He never, not a doctor at all, but a piano technician. So he bought the whole bundle, big box of these tools. I said, what in the world are we going to do with all this junk? Well, it's not junk. So he spent 3 days sorting these tools in different piles, and this will do this, and this will do this. And he took out what he wanted mostly and took the rest to an auction of chapter of piano technicians, and they went ape over all these tools that they could do to work on pianos that they were originally created to work on people. And everybody was excited about all these fancy new tools that are not available in the piano supply book.
I don't know what you mean by it, because now we take a symphony. When a symphony orchestra plays a piece of music, they never play it twice exactly the same way. Now, you mean that we're going to set it up with a synthesizer and that's it? No, there's going to be no variation, there's going to be no difference from then on?
Well, the bad news is that the synthesizers could be set up to play it differently also from time to time.
The touchness that you have to get. Playing music is one thing, and playing music perfectly is one thing. Playing synthesizers perfectly is an entirely different thing. We don't know what we're doing.
Yeah.
I don't think that's very soon. Anyway.
Yeah.
The question to you, one point is, speak on this matter, please. Say in a symphony orchestra, you have first violins, 15 of them, a dozen second violins, playing or attempting to play precisely, identically. What is the need for that? What is the role of the multi-instrument made? Each instrument is made to be about as close as possible to the next one. They're all trying to play together, and I can't tell that they're not in good things. So what is the function of that? What is the impact of that in synthetic music?
What is the impact of
the time to study motion engineers said, look, there's 12 violins all playing together. All you need is one and an amplifier.
As a matter of fact, that is true. The reason there are 12 violins is not, well, I suppose there are sociological reasons why 12 people want to come together to play. But from a technological standpoint, 12 violins produce a sound that is better than any one of them alone. They're louder, but also I think, and I'm not terribly familiar with the technological treatment of this, but the noise, that is the undesirable things that come out of the violin, are smoothed out and blended out in a with 12 planes. So I think there's a technological reason for 12 violins to be in the first violin section, over and against just the sociological one. But from a technical standpoint, that can be synthesized. That is, the 12 can be synthesized fairly easily. Well, I shouldn't say fairly easily.
Could I interject a thought? There's a book by a Dutchman. I don't think I can pronounce his name properly. It's called, the name of the book is Homo Ludens. And what it is, it's a treatise on the subject of the play spirit in man. And he thinks that practically all the things we do are examples of the place of the spirit of play in man. In fact, for instance, he believes that courts in which games are played, the court of justice, the area in which a religious ritual is carried out, are really examples of the play spirit, the creative, which is part of the creative spirit of man.
Interesting.
I think his name is Huizinga, but I'm not sure about the pronunciation. Homo Ludens is the title of the book. It's really a fascinating
discussion.
What about
the personal satisfaction of taking lessons and accomplishing something? Will it sort of disappear? Sit down and have
I don't think so. The point, I'm here today is to say that this technique could possibly lead us down a track of producing music perfectly. I say that's not the point at all. I think the point is that we need to raise the question about what it means to make music. And I mentioned this before, I think the poets among us have been doing this continuously. The artists have, the musicians have, but us engineers and also us that are becoming ever more ingrained in this technological society aren't asking that question perhaps enough, or at least I'm advocating that we ask it and ask it kind of continuously. Yes?
You're scaring me. Technology can get to the point that music can be synchronized so perfectly, in quotation marks, that all we have to do is sit at home, punch a button, and hear a symphony. That there won't be this opportunity to go and sit and participate with all your feeling in the feelings of the producers. There's nothing that's more gorgeous than to sit and watch the face of Isaac Stern or Pearl as they play that.
Isn't it?
The body language and the feelings that come out of them and are sunk into yourself. That would be a horrible world.
Wouldn't it be terrible? But my point is that technology has within it the possibility of placing an engineer in Cleveland doing all that stuff. And I'm saying that we need to a great extent ask the question what it means to make music and get at what you're talking about. Yeah. Have you seen The Joy of Bach movie?
Yeah.
If you haven't seen it, it'll be played here.
We can see it here.
That's so magnificent. It's showing Bach's music played by so many people in many environments. I couldn't agree with you more. And my point is we need to be raising those questions. And it applies not only to music.
Right.
It applies to our whole lives. Technology is pervading our whole lives, similar to that, and we need to be asking the question, why, how are we going to continue to be co-creators? Pierre?
I was just wanting to ask that woman if you could write and play and listen to the symphony that you created all by yourself, would that not be an enriching experience?
The joy of
Bach.
Feeling that you're participating in a two-way, three-way, really, with all the audience, the symphony.
I don't know if that's the nature or the significance that you experience in that context when you go to hear a symphony. I'm wondering if you go and walk in the woods, or if creating a symphony and listening to it was that easy as a walk in solitude in the woods.
That still an ingredient missing, I think.
That's a commonality. I'm wondering if there isn't a nature of commonality that something entirely different from listening to people create things. Like joining in worship or silence or being together, uncreatively, just being together, imbued with the spirit that we share, that we don't create.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting really anxious about this, that there's something that's just not being talked about that gives us the capacity to do all this other creating very perfectly.
Gary, you're going to have to say more.
Yeah. Apologies to all. You're talking less, I think, about synthesized music as between live performance and otherwise. And that's my opening. Having been brought up as far as music is concerned, mostly by hearing the symphony on the radio on Sundays and the opera on Saturdays, that comes over one pair of wires into one loudspeaker, producing a composite noise. And so now is a great privilege of going to the symphony orchestra somewhere, hearing a, to me, perfectly rendered production, which comes as a composite noise from the shell, from the stage. The orchestra makes one composite noise, and it begins such and such from the third movement of Brahms' First Symphony. It was, for me, a discovery. I don't know how long ago. It's just a nothing, but it was, to me, a great discovery that I realized one day, even though I was hearing an orchestra playing in a large auditorium, a perfect notes along, I realized that I was not hearing a symphonic orchestra. I was hearing 100 different musical instruments, and each single instrument took an infinite number of paths, bouncing off of everything to get to this ear, and each instrument took an infinite number of paths, bouncing off of everything to get to this ear. Now we go on to the next instrument, all playing at the same time. The symphony, the Greeks say symphony, they agree, sound together. The symphony was not on the stage. The symphony is in my ears, in my nerves, in my brain. That's the symphony. It is simply that there are a bunch of contenders out there who are doing something, but they're doing it so well that they are sending noises which arrive together to my ears where the symphony occurs. Now that is participation. I think the subject today is not, if you will, the creation of music synthetically versus conventional ways, but it is rather how we would receive it. We as listeners would become accustomed to, adapt to, reject, resign to, or what have you, as listeners. And I think that the realization that we make music as listeners, particularly under complex circumstances, is the great sustaining, a great sustaining, even though we can't play diddly with a comb and tissue paper.
I happen to be a clergyman, and I'm just wondering about heaven. And wonder if we present from the pulpits heaven as a place of perfect synthesis. We wonder if we don't need to do a little thinking there about just the particular place that each person has there.
I was thinking that you play the trumpet, they have electronic bell instrument. You play one of those?
No.
It's a synthetic trumpet, but it has a valve on it, so it's kind of it has a mouthpiece that you blow in, so it sounds almost exactly like a trumpet, and you still have control over the tone of the mouthpiece, so it's kind of a combination of the synthesizer and the original instrument. It has a lot bigger range and a lot bigger variety of sounds. It can sound like a trombone or a clarinet, but there's still the touch sensitivity with the mouthpiece, so it's really hard to tell the difference between that and a regular trumpet.
Interesting. Rudy.
Well, that gentleman over there
he described so well the process, the mechanical process, to me, of getting that sound into his ear. But part of that whole thing, the excitement of the visual, is just tremendous. I mean, last week we had these accordion players. If we'd have had just a speaker there, would never have amounted to what we saw. There's people operating the instruments. That visual excitement is part of the experience that you never get from a board with punching buttons.
And added to that, I think, is also the awareness that these are human beings such as we are, that we are in contact with them, and that we sort of feel elevated as human beings because human beings are doing this. I think of the times that I looked at Navajo rugs and said, well, one of the important, that actually the women who did these rugs would put an imperfection in it, perhaps like a synthesizer, in order to say that a human being has done this. This is not done by a machine, because a machine could do it so perfectly. Yeah. And that they would purposely make a mistake, have a flaw, if you could call it that, in the rug. Because there was... Humans have done it. And I think the very fact that there's, you know, grandma's cookies and handmade and things like that are terms that sell things suggests how much we want to have that in about us.
I think it's significant that that little flaw in a Navajo rug is termed a spirit trail.
Thank you.
Oh. I don't like that.
I was wondering how much optimum creativity is in some of the music I hear on the radio today. As I drive down the road, I can't find something I like to listen to. And I think a lot of us can experience that. You're not going to hear the best orchestra or symphony. It's a lot of junk music. Is that a creative talent?
Rudy, what do you think about that?
Just like in the orchestra, that when you hear of an orchestra or a symphony advertised, the conductor is always mentioned. That man up there front, he's just gestulating and going through it, and your eye is on that man. You hardly observe the instruments, but he apparently has something to do with humans. Just want to see somebody conduct. Thank you.
Of course, he is a synthesizer.
That's like using a Cuisinart to make bread. You know, that leaves me absolutely cold to use my Cuisinart to mix bread, because that actual mixing of the bread dough is the most satisfying process. It's so artificial with a Cuisinart.
You mean you have to have a
I have a feeling that you have to
Not anymore.
I understood the imperfection of Navajo rugs to be to differentiate ourselves from God, not to differentiate ourselves from machines.
Well, that may be true. I don't know enough about
the spirit trail. It's called a spirit trail.
The spirit trail. For me, that is my affinity with it. You see, I may not understand, but still appreciate that this was done.
So do you. What if you were God?
Well, we're at the end of the hour, and I said that this would probably raise more questions than it has answered. I'm sure that's true. I think the important point is that the questions be asked and dealt with, and I appreciate very much the conversation that we've had here today, discussion. Thanks a lot.